Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. This was a real problem, especially as COVID came about the scene, where people get their information and how credible is it really? Well, right on the heels of National News Literacy Week, or weekend, we're going to be talking about misinformation and ways to be sure what you're reading online actually has real value. Joining me now is Krista Carnes, our social media consultant. Good morning, Krista. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well.
Is it weekend or week?
It's News Literacy Week by a news literacy organization called Newslit.org, which is a nonpartisan journalism, fact-based organization that's, wants to help us all be better consumers of so much of what we have access to, which is different than when I was growing up and a heck of a lot different than when my mom was growing up. And, because, people tend to manipulate at a faster rate than people can, sort of regulate or, sort of stay ahead of things, there's a lot of misuse and sometimes downright sort of, really, really negative outcomes of people misusing information mm-hmm. in order to, try to, affect the changes that they want to see and rally people around their ideas. Propaganda is nothing new, but there's so much, content and images and things that we all have access to that manipulating those for your own purposes on both sides of the political spectrum, is something we all really need to watch out for. And it's a constant thing. So this news literacy organization, I'm not affiliated with them. I just think they do great work. I work in a school and we work with, there's some educator oriented content. There's also some public ones and they have some really interesting quizzes, for example, their program is called Checkology, and you can go through a quiz and, it will present you with situations and you sort of judge, and it will show you how sort of good or bad you are at sussing out real information from misinformation. Mm-hmm. And even as, someone with a journalism and communications background and somebody who works in social media, even I got tripped up on a couple of them. So it's something that it's a muscle we have to develop and keep going.
Absolutely. And I think, Krista, I think you make a very good point, because I know even for myself, we talk about scams, for example, and I work in news just like you do. And I'll tell you every sign, shape, everything you need to know about a scam. And yet I feel I've almost been duped by scams so many times that's exactly it. It's a muscle that even those who work in this industry have to really work to detect if something is real, if it's credible, if it's authentic, or if it's just bogus. And there might be aspects of something you're reading that is based in truth or has aspects of truth, but the entire thing is not vetted. It's not credible. And it does turn into a lot of problems. And like I use the example of COVID, COVID, unfortunately, the reason it's so jaded right now. I mean, the fact that people are debating whether or not should we get a vaccine, should we not get a vaccine, unless you're somebody who has a medical reason why you shouldn't. A lot of the reason people have worries about, will I never have children if I get the vaccine? That's all social media. And just, unfortunately, falsehoods being spread everywhere.
And you're right about the, one of the most, I think, insidious aspects of this is like what you were talking about. It's false correlations and using things out of context. So you might take one piece of one study and then attach it to
blow it up into something.
Might attach it to something else. And I think, we talk about the mental health crisis that kids are in, and that is absolutely, something that people are, parents and teachers are experiencing. But then they say, but then some people will say, well, that's only because of masks. Do you know what I mean?
Right. They take a small aspect. Exactly. That's exactly right.
So we have to be really, I think one of the things that, as this news literacy organization emphasizes, I think is an important point is, if something feels, if you read it and you feel like it's meant to elicit a strong emotion, whether it's anger, fear, even hope, or something really like a positive emotion, it's almost a signal to look deeper into it, because information is balanced, or at least, you know, you it should be something that's presented to you that you choose how you feel about it. It's not supposed to invoke something. So that's a way to sort of signal, huh, do I need to look into this a little deeper? Mm-hmm. Going back and making sure of when a photo was taken, when a study was done, who did it? And we're not always going to know the most reputable organizations, because you can make a website look really reputable. But if it's an anonymous website, and we're seeing this in a lot of local elections, groups are popping up. They're not assigning their names to Facebook groups or websites, and throwing all this information together, but yet there's no way to reach out to that person. If I was a member of the press and wanted to get a comment, there's no person to reach out to. If somebody can't put their name on something, that's a big red flag. Mm-hmm. And that is everywhere now. And it's easy when you've gotten people whisked up into, you know, sort of a frenzy about something to just keep feeding that fear. I mean, I think I said to you in the pre-prep for this, the AARP is doing news literacy workshops at senior centers because, you know, like a lot of people in their 70s and 80s are on social media, and they were raised in a time of Walter Cronkite and,
exactly.
You know,
they don't exist that much anymore. Yep. You're right.
I mean, you really had to go out of your way to find the propaganda then.
Exactly.
And you know, that kind of stuff. So
it's reversed now.
It is.
It's reversed
now.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. the Aspen, we can post this if you want after the show. The Aspen Institute just conducted a huge study with all kinds of thought leaders from across the spectrum, politically, across the spectrum, academically, and Katie Couric actually wrote it. And it's talking about, you know, the importance, you know, sort of this disinformation age and the damage that this can do, because, you know, it used to be that we believed an informed society was going to make the best decisions. And using this is being weaponized against them on both sides of the spectrum. Again, I think most of us are pretty moderate. I think most of us, you know, want what's best for the world and to take care of ourselves. And this is just, it should make us angry that we're being manipulated.
Yeah.
And that's
and I think that's why, you know, the conversation I want to continue, because it's true. I think that we've gone from an informed public to a manipulated public. And what's sad about it too, Krista, is that some people don't even realize they have been manipulated. So I want to talk a little bit more about this, especially, you know, when we talk about online groups and having chats and things like that, how you could take one or two manipulated people and make a mass out of them. So, Krista, we're chatting about misinformation and ways to be sure what you're reading on social media is actually credible. And what I wanted to kind of dive into is the fact that people aren't even aware that the information they are getting is actually manipulating them sometimes. And one of the examples I'm going to use, I've actually seen in my own family members. I have some family members who only watch CNN, and I have some family members who only watch Fox. And it's interesting, it's not until I started working this show that they, both sides, have sort of realized, like, oh, I didn't see that in last night's news. I didn't hear anything about that. And I'm like, right, because you're getting one-sided news. And what's sad about that is that more and more news coverage nationally, not locally so much, but national coverage has become biased. It has been politicized, or it has become whatever they feel the majority would want to hear. And that's just not what you said, what historically news was supposed to be. That's not what journalists were supposed to do. But unfortunately, when you have people who are paying big bucks to have you swing a certain way, that's the coverage you're getting. And I guess my question to you is, how do people take a step back and open their minds and go, well, you know what, maybe I just researched the idea of, are there other news outlets I should be turning to than what I'm doing right now?
Yes. Okay. So, you know, a lot of things changed back, honestly, I believe it was when Bill Clinton was president, and they relaxed all the rules on news and what was considered news and what was considered opinion. And, you know, MSNBC and Fox are very similar organizations in terms of, it's just one big opinion person after another. Mm-hmm. And you know, sometimes you watch it because we all have, there's a lot of biases that make us feel informed, that make us feel better. Confirmation bias is one of them, watching what you already know to reinforce what you already believe. It's a human nature. And that's one thing we could talk about that on another show, very different kinds of, there's all kinds of different biases out there. And that those kinds of networks and that kind of journalism, if you can even call it journalism, is meant to sort of play on that.
Right. It's opinionated journalism. Right. Right.
It's opinionated journalism. Mm-hmm. They recently released a new one for 2022, but there's organization that puts out and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but that puts out a spectrum of
how much accuracy or whatever. Yeah.
But yeah, based on the bias.
Yes.
Right? And
yes. I've seen that
PBS
before.
NewsHour, pretty much in the middle. Boring to some, but pretty, very,
it's
very
accurate,
balanced
though.
And
yep.
like sort of
yeah.
adhering
yeah.
to that. And I have a friend who teaches sociology and history, and every year she has half, a bunch of her students listen to NPR and a bunch of students listen to the evening news on MAC. So she gives them each a different network, uh-huh. and they come in and share, what were the top stories,
what was the emphasis. Great assignment. I love that.
Right. And it kind of shows them. So, being judicious on what you choose to consume and giving read the other side, listen to the other side, experiment. And then there are resources that, some people think the Associated Press is pretty balanced. Reuters is pretty balanced. International resources like the BBC can
yes.
give different perspectives mm-hmm. On similar stories. So when a story is important to you, finding the different resources to kind of give yourself a perspective and then say, okay, how much of this, what are they trying to get me to? Are they trying to get me to do something? Are they trying to persuade me? Is this just informational? There's lots of resources to help you, like a checklist almost. And I think this is what they're trying to teach in schools to kids, because they have to be what they're calling now like digital detectives, mm-hmm. right? They have to.
Which is crazy.
But
you have to.
Right?
And you have to. Mm-hmm.
You have to. And we as adults, that's asking a lot of us. So keeping an open mind, being curious, realizing we all have a lot to still learn is like the first step. And then, not necessarily blaming one outlet over another, but balancing together and, making sure that, when you have conversations in person or on that online chat or in that Facebook group, bring the receipts, as they say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, I just read this article by X. This is what I think about that. And then someone will say, well, I find that to be a very biased article because of this. You encourage the conversation and sort of resist the urge, hopefully, to be defensive about it. Because when people get defensive, that's another signal they know that their story doesn't hold water completely.
And it's interesting, Krista, this week, for example, I have to be honest, we had a story, which I'm sure you heard about, the Fairfield situation where the man ran into the Robex through the drink. Okay. So I tell the story. Okay. And I have to be honest, I watched almost every news outlet yesterday report on this story completely in the victim's point of view. I totally understand. Mm. You're talking about an 18-year-old girl. She had a drink thrown at her. Absolutely. I understand. However, it is not our job as journalists to choose sides. It is our job to tell a story and to tell it accurately and to tell it fully.
Yes.
And I have to be honest with you. I'm not saying I'm the only news outlet, because I've seen in 24 hours how many people have changed how they wrote the story. But I said no one mentioned that this guy's son had an allergic reaction to the point that he had to go to the hospital. It just sounds like a crazy man ran into a store and threw a drink. Now, again, were his actions okay? Absolutely not. But as a journalist, your job is to tell both sides of the story. And unfortunately, I got to be honest, when I told his side, when I said this guy, this is why he did it, not condoning it, but this is why he did it, I have to be honest with you. I got emails. I got phone calls. Mm. How dare you even give this guy a say? How dare you? Because that's my job. And the fact that we can't tell both sides of a story, that's how political our news has become. We would prefer, we attack people and we don't tell a full story. That's what we would prefer as a society. And it's terrible. I think it's terrible.
And here's what you're up against as a journalist. And here's what you're up against is that story got out. It used to be that when something happened, when there was breaking news, you had to come back to your newsroom. You had to check with your editor.
Yes,
you had to verify more than one source.
Right.
I learned in journalism school, there's an old mantra that says, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. right? Like, you got to go get confirmation.
But that's just it, Krista. This went on TikTok and it just went on the news. Oh my gosh, have you seen this TikTok video? This poor girl gets attacked. No one explains why this guy comes in like a raving lunatic. Nobody explained why. And again, I'm not condoning his actions. I want to make that very clear. But the story was not complete. And I was always taught in school, you complete the story before you go informing the public. You do not do a piece that's only half done. You cannot tell the public about a half done story. You say it's developing. This is what we're hearing about, whatever it is. But until you have confirmation, I hate the way news is now. I don't know if you could tell,
but I hate it. Because, you know, people see things with their own eyes. But you're right. There's not necessarily context. And obviously, you know, there was things that he said and things that he did that were shocking, but I mean,
but you can think
that there's never going to be justification, but what are the facts here? You know, and that's an extreme example, but if that's happening all the time, you know, and consequences are going to be what consequences are. Mm-hmm. But I do feel that we're always trying to, you know, you're rushing to these things before they even have a chance to actually like gel at all. I mean,
because
like,
you want to be first and you want to get ratings. That's what it's become.
And there's no value in letting things percolate for a little while and taking some perspective. So again, there's another thing is there's instant information, there's short form information, and there's long form information. And when you're really committed to an issue and trying, you know, you got to read the long articles from different long publications because you're provided historical context. You're provided all these things, and you can't get that in a 4-minute soundbite, you can only do the facts. And I, you know, and sad but true. I mean, maybe if you'd, I don't know, preface the story by saying like, I'm just bringing the facts. I mean, if you have to like, you know, sort of identify yourself as a journalist and what that means, maybe because we've forgotten. I think it's changed.
Right? I think the definition of a journalist, I think, has absolutely changed. And unfortunately, Krista, we have run out of time. But if people want to connect with you and chat more or hear more about this week with finding misinformation and really finding good, accurate news out there, is there a way they can connect with you?
Yeah, I'm just like getting my new Twitter handle locked up because my other one got taken and I can't get it back. So I'm now at Krista Carnes 22. And you know, I'll send you, Melissa, maybe some links and things to some of the stuff I mentioned today, and
that'd
maybe we can post it. And I welcome questions. I mean, I think we have to ask questions and not be afraid to, you know, say what we don't know.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Krista, thank you so much for opening up the conversation on the show. I appreciate it.
All right, Melissa, you take good care. Have a good week.
You too. We'll talk soon. Nuvans Health is one of a selected few sites in the United States enrolling participants in a study evaluating a certain diet in people with advanced pancreatic cancer. It's an incredible opportunity. And as I mentioned, a study only being done at a few select sites, including right here in Norwalk, Connecticut at Nuvans Health. Joining me now is Dr. Richard Frank with the latest. Good morning, Dr. Frank. Thanks for being on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, Dr. Frank, I'm sure going to botch the name of this diet. Is it ketogenic or ketogenic? How do you say it?
Ketogenic.
Ketogenic. Okay, ketogenic diet. First of all, what is a ketogenic diet?
It's a diet that is low in carbohydrates, much lower than the average diet, higher in fats, a little less in protein, but basically it alters the balance of a regular diet so that it's lower in carbohydrates, which typically gets broken down in the body to glucose. It's the main glucose supply. So over time, if you're taking in fewer carbohydrates, your body slowly changes the level of glucose, declines a bit. Insulin, which regulates glucose, drops a lot. And your body uses alternative sources of fuel for the cells called ketone bodies rather than glucose. And that's why the diet is called a ketogenic diet.
Okay, so this is keto. I feel so silly asking. Yeah. Okay, this is a keto diet. Oh,
right.
Okay. I was totally thrown off when I saw the genic. I'm like, oh, is this the same thing? Okay, I've done keto before. Keto's incredible. I mean, it's the only reason I had to stop keto was because I abused cheese too much. And and they were worried, my doctors were worried I was going to have like a heart attack or something.
Right.
So keto, but oh my gosh, I think I lost weight faster than anything on a keto diet. And I know a lot of people find a lot of success mess with them. What, you know, how does keto work differently than like another diet, you know, a very, I would say, popular diet on the marketplace? Like, how does keto sort of work? How does it help your body?
Well, that's it. It makes the liver break down fatty acids and fat to burn them into sources of energy called ketone bodies, and rather than glucose. And so that's why you burn fat. It basically transitions to make you burn fat for energy. Now, the reason that these ketone bodies are not a great source of fuel for cells, and especially in cancer cells, they can inhibit the growth of cancer cells. And like you said, long-term, it's not a healthy way to live. It's not recommended as a lifestyle, but it has been shown to reduce seizures in children. There have been several smaller studies in patients with various cancers, because cancer itself, a large cancer tumor like a pancreas cancer, relies on glucose a lot for energy, and it's also in a very low oxygen environment because of the nature of the tumor growth. And so all of that makes the cancer cell more reliant on glucose. And if you gum up that system, if you reduce the glucose supply and increase these ketone bodies, you can inhibit the growth of the cancer. But in particular, in association with a chemotherapy combination, it seems to work best. And that's what the study is testing.
This is fascinating. Wow. So how long have you guys been doing this study for?
Just a few months. The study is being run in combination with the Mayo Clinic and Translational Genomics, basically a think tank out in Arizona. And patients are randomized. This is for people who have not yet received any treatment for advanced pancreatic cancer. Typically, they're treated with two chemotherapy drugs. We add a third drug, and before that, patients are randomized to receive a ketogenic diet or a normal diet. Those who get a ketogenic diet are followed very closely. They're monitored by professionals. Their daily glucose and ketone bodies are measured in their blood to make sure they have a state of ketosis. And there's a lot of communication to make sure that they're living healthy. You know, they're not jeopardizing their health at all. But you're kind of altering the metabolic balance. And so it's a very intensive a diet in the study. Mm-hmm. That's basically the premise.
Dr. Frank is here of New Vance Health, and if you're just tuning in, New Vance Health is one of a selected few sites in the U.S. enrolling participants in a study evaluating a keto diet in people with advanced pancreatic cancer. How did New Vance Health even end up on the map, Dr. Frank? I mean, that's pretty impressive in itself that it's one of only a few sites doing this study.
Yeah. Well, we've recently published a large series of our patients with pancreatic cancer, and we really were the first to show that those who had good glucose regulation during chemotherapy lived longer. And so, and also, I'm running one of the first or only studies of early detection of pancreatic cancer in patients who have new onset diabetes. So there's a lot of research going on between the link of cancer, pancreatic cancer, and metabolism. And so our research kind of got the attention of these researchers, and we, you know, got together and talked and thought it would be great for us to join their study.
I know it's only been a few months, Dr. Frank, but are we already starting to see that being on a keto diet does slow the growth of a pancreatic cancer?
Can't tell you yet.
It's too early. Yeah.
There's a lot of, animal work. It's all based on good science. But patients are just enrolling now, so just don't know.
Yeah, it's too soon. I'm curious, do you still have openings for people if they want to be part of the study?
We do.
You do. So how do people apply for that?
The best thing is to call or go online or call our research office. 203-852-2996.
Okay. And again, that's Nuvans Health's office. I think I have another number here as well. The Nuvans Health Cancer Research is 203-739-7997. There's an email if you want to email over to Nuvans Health. Of course, you can contact us and we can give you those details as well. And Dr. Frank, last question. How long will you do this study for? How long will this go on for?
I imagine at least in 1 year.
Okay.
To enroll a sufficient number of people so that we know that it's potentially promising and that it will be expanded.
Wow, that could be certainly life-changing for people with pancreatic cancer. Do you think this would help other types of cancers if you find good results?
It is being studied, yeah. At a lot of other hospitals, bigger centers as well. And so, you know, researchers are really turning on to it. So yeah, I think you're going to see it tested in other cancers.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, Dr. Frank, as soon as you have any results or you have any updates, we'd love to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help. Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
It's one of my favorite songs of all time, The Times They Are A-Changin' by Bob Dylan. But you know, Julius Dudix is here, our morning show counselor. And unfortunately, Julius, the topic of change, it doesn't really sit well with a lot of folks. We're creatures of habit. Do you find that it continues to be a real problem for people?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a major source for stress and anxiety in people, or even depressive thought. I want to change, but I can't change. And change really starts with a positive attitude. And we run around telling ourselves, you know, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. When the truth, what's the truth? Yes, you can do it. But our internal dialogue is so negative sometimes that we end up being our own worst enemy. But change takes a lot of energy. And Melissa, really, some people say, well, he's not going to change because he's lazy. They're just lazy. Or maybe you're telling yourself, I'm lazy. But laziness can really be exhaustion. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, substituting new behaviors for old behaviors can be just so exhausting.
Yeah.
Mentally exhausting, physically exhausting. It's just an exhausting process.
Mm-hmm.
So our brains are our toughest opponents.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, if you read any article on this, too, like, for example, like the Journal of Business and Psychology, you know, it looks at how stress, you know, when change causes stress, what are the effects, you know, what are your, you know, personal, what are the effects on you personally? And you know, and when you read through some of these studies and you look at, for example, one of the biggest stresses is employment stress. And, you know, I joke about it a lot, Julius, but I say to people all the time when they're like, oh, what's your next step? You know, working in the media industry, where are you going next? And I say to people, I got to be honest with you. First of all, I love the job I do. But second of all, just going to another station, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do the changes. You know, I love all of you, but it's like, I just don't want to change stations, change protocols, change colleagues.
Right.
You know, it's that's a lot of stress in itself. And I think inevitably, sometimes change is really good. It's actually really good for people to go through changes. But sometimes I do think people change because they're bored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it does cause more stress on your life than it does actually, like, the grass is greener on the other side. Is it really? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like,
right.
Sometimes people change because they feel like they have to, when really, you know, it's okay to just be comfortable, I think, but maybe I'm wrong.
As long as you're not comfortable in your uncomfortness, and by uncomfortness, I mean, do you really enjoy what you're doing? And take, for instance, what part of your life do you really want to change? And is it really meaningful and useful? And is it really going to be a helpful thing for you down the road 5 years from now if you do change that particular habit? You can talk about smoking. You can talk about exercise. You can talk about eating habits or whatever. Sometimes people don't want to change because they don't want to look dumb, or your family or coworkers or your friends think it's a bad idea. And we are driven by what other people think as opposed to what we think we should be doing to be the best version of ourselves.
That's another
issue that a lot of people face. But you got to really sit back and say, you know, what is it? What are the barriers preventing me from changing? And is it best for me to move in a different direction and go to a new radio station? I mean, that's a great thing to entertain. But the issue really is, what's going to make me most productive, happiest and a really a better person kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Julius Dudix this morning. So, Julius, you know, with change, like you said, it's inevitable. People are going to go through changes, good, bad, or indifferent. And especially going into a new year, a lot of people love to make changes in a new year. But sometimes you're kind of on the sidelines, and while you're watching people make changes, you're stressing and you're overwhelming over what is this going to mean for me. What are some of your, you know, tips, tricks to handling change a little bit better?
Yeah, you got to start small. Don't overwhelm yourself, but start really small. I've said this before, I believe, but exercise doesn't have to be a whole hour at the gym. It can be just a 20-minute segment, or even a 10-minute, or can you do 5 minutes? A 5-minute walk versus a half hour walk. But you've got to just one habit at a time. Start small, and maybe even do a 30-day challenge, or a 7-day challenge, and maybe set up a behavioral modification type of a system where you reward yourself. If I do this for 7 days, I'm gonna do this kind of thing, and you make it positive. But you've got to make a plan and write it down, and know what motivates you, and make sure those motivations are strong enough for you to continue. And then one of the biggest things, Melissa, is surround yourself with people you can trust, that you can talk to, that you can share with, that will hold you accountable, that will encourage you. Your network is huge in life. Mm-hmm. But write down all your obstacles. What are the things preventing me from changing? And begin to address those one by one by one. But really, it's a repetitive pattern of behavior that you're trying to embrace, and ultimately understand that, hey, there's a sovereign God who sometimes allows us to go through difficulty in a work situation where my boss isn't really as happy with me as he used to be. Maybe that's for a reason. Maybe God rocks the boat to blow us in a different direction so that we begin to fulfill his destiny for us. So all change is not bad. But when you do contemplate change, you've got to really start small.
Yeah. Well, and as I mentioned, change is a very hard thing for a lot of people. And it certainly helps when you have support to get through some of those stresses that come with change. Julius, is there a way people could reach out to you if they want your help?
Sure. You can make an appointment by calling 203-243-7714. Or you can read about me on the LinkedIn or Facebook, or the www.bark.com. You can fill out the form there, and it'll take you right to my profile online.
All right. Well, Julius Dudix, we always appreciate having you on the show to help us through some of life's obstacles. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you for all you do, Melissa. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. I want to tell you about a program which is called Gen Cyber Teacher Academy. It's at the University of New Haven, and it's going to be happening this summer. It's a free professional development opportunity for high school teachers across Connecticut with STEM backgrounds. Immediately, I could think of some of my favorite teachers when I was at Laurelton Hall who would absolutely love this program and such a cool opportunity. To talk a little bit more about this is an associate professor of computer science and cybersecurity, Mehdi Mekni, who is here this morning. Good morning, Mehdi. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me over.
So first of all, Mehdi, is this a brand new program? I've never heard of it before.
Well, the program is not new, but this session or this edition is actually the first one in Connecticut.
That's really cool. So how many teachers do you guys end up teaching for like this one week in August?
So we are targeting 25 high school teachers, 9, 12 grades of Connecticut high schools. So the number of seats is limited. And we hope with this opportunity today to get the word out and to invite these amazing people who are doing a great job day after day to join this opportunity, as you said, of professional development and develop skills in order to integrate more cybersecurity material and content about online safety and pass it to the students in their classrooms.
I'm curious, Mehdi, where did you guys get the money to host this program?
So the program is actually funded by the National Science Foundation and the National Security Agency, two of the largest federal agencies, in order to raise awareness around the K-12 cybersecurity contents and cybersecurity post-secondary and career opportunities at the national level. And we were trying, as the University of New Haven, to land this opportunity in order to benefit our high school teacher community here in Connecticut and make this professional development opportunity possible for them.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about it. We're talking this morning to Mehdi Mekni, who is an associate professor of computer science and cybersecurity at the University of New Haven. And we're talking about this program. It's called Gen Cyber Teacher Academy. It's going to be happening August 8th to the 12th. And I'm going to go through some of the things that participating teachers will get. How can you apply? All of that we'll go through in just a minute. But, you know, Mehdi, why target high school teachers? What do you feel this will benefit not only the teachers, but with their curriculum, their students? You know, why do you feel this is important?
Well, it is important first to recognize that the nation is facing a critical shortfall of skilled cybersecurity professionals. So solution in order to overcome this issue included programs like the Gen Cyber program that we are offering. There are actually two of them. There is one that is targeting students and one that is targeting teachers. The one that is targeting students, the outcomes are obvious. We're going to have more students who are going to be aware and interested into cybersecurity and potentially pursuing post-secondary programs and eventually professional careers in this field. Personally, what motivated me in order to apply and get this opportunity for the Gen Cyber Teacher Academy is actually the long-term return of investment in terms of effort and energy. We are investing in our high school teachers. They are training, educating our kids, and basically investing in these teachers is influencing, impacting the generations to come. So there are going to be multiple generations of students who are going to be educated, trained around cybersecurity concepts and the importance of online safety. And we're going to have much more return of investment, or I would say much more, we're going to raise more awareness around those threats and build that capacity to overcome those threats.
And in, you know, like you said, this is going to be something that, sure, they take a week and they do all these lessons, but then this is something they could bring to their curriculum. This is something that they can pass on to their students. And it, my understanding, too, is that one of the things that they'll receive if they're part of this program is actually a free membership to Gen Cyber Teaching Learning Community, which I would think they could continue to get more more resources, more understanding, more learning under their belt, and continue updating their curriculum year to year, no?
Exact. So actually, the outcomes of this program goes beyond the learning experience that our teacher will benefit from. So our teacher will have a $1,500 stipend upon completion of the activities of this summer program. They will also benefit from a brand new Chromebook that they will be able to take back home or back to their classrooms. And of course, they will develop under the advising and mentorship of pedagogical experts lesson plans in order for them to integrate cybersecurity content into their courses, curriculum, and teaching material. And of course, as you just mentioned, they're going to be invited in order to be part of this hopefully growing community, the Gen Cyber Teacher Learning Community in Connecticut.
Yeah, it's a really incredible opportunity. Like I said, looking at this, Mehdi, there are a lot of things you get as a participant, including a $1,500 stipend if you complete the program, a free Chromebook, lesson plan, certificate of completion, of course, that free membership I mentioned. But it is only open to 25 spots. Again, this is coming up August 8th to the 12th, so this summer. And again, you do have to apply. The deadline to do that is May 1st, and you could do that online at GenCyber. That's gencyber.newhaven.edu. Again, gencyber.newhaven.edu. And Mehdi, we are so looking forward to seeing these teachers grow and have this opportunity. Thank you so much for sharing the news here on our show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation, and thank you for bringing this this news to our high school community out there in Connecticut.
Absolutely. And again, this is for teachers 9th through 12th grade. So if you want to get in on the action, apply today at gencyber.newhaven.edu. Thank you so much, Mehdi.